couple of days after we sail across the front of the glacier, the winds change. And we started seeing more big icebergs just sort of floating by. And no one really knows why until...
That's the image that we got yesterday morning.
Some of the scientists on the ship are sent these satellite images.
Lots of icebergs and brash ice.
Showing that all these icebergs are coming from Thwaites.
So in just a few days, it transformed.
The part of Thwaites Glacier that we had just sailed by basically all broke up, possibly because of that shift in winds. What is the significance of this event in terms of how we understand what's happening at Thwaites?
It's another step in the steady retreat.
This is Rob Larder, the chief scientist on the ship.
One expression of the fact that Thwaites Glacier is losing more and more ice.
And this matters because the ice shelf, which is the portion of Thwaites that extends off of land and floats on the sea, it stabilizes the entire glacier.
This zone here, which is about 40 kilometers wide.
Rob says this big blowout confirms that there's really very little actual ice shelf left at this part of Thwaites Glacier.
You'd expect that this might lead to even further acceleration of flow of the glacier.
So Rob tells me that probably next year, during the next summer thaw, if the line of stability retreats further inland, then we'll know that this maybe was a big deal.
You just have to wait and see.
So if this entire ice shelf crumbles, what's left at the edge of Thwaites is just a giant cliff of ice that's exposed to the warm water that's melting it. And that ice gets thicker and thicker the farther it goes inland into Antarctica, because the seafloor underneath it is kind of like a valley. And if the ice retreats enough to where it reaches a certain thickness, it'll just start collapsing under its own weight. And scientists are afraid there might not be anything to stop it.
You could get a domino effect of icebergs falling off of the edge of an ice sheet.
I talked about this with Allie Graham, who's a marine geophysicist on the ship.
And there's still a debate over what it would look like, and actually we could be observing it right now and not really realize that it's happening, and that's kind of scary.
This idea of how Thwaites might collapse one day, it's not well understood yet, so it's making a lot of people pretty nervous.
How quickly you can feasibly collapse something like Thwaites? Is it over a century? Is it over 1,000 years? Or can you do it in a decade? And I don't think anyone can, hand on heart, say which of those it is yet.
So we start heading home after the sea basically starts freezing up in the area that the scientists want to study. Day 52 of the trip, we reach far enough north that we have some internet again. Morning, Peter.
Good morning.
I notice you are on your phone.
Yes, because we've got internet again. And I'm 27, and this is basically the best thing that's ever happened to me.
And that was kind of a moment when it felt like the spell of the ship was broken. So we weren't just our own floating universe off in the middle of nowhere.
It's like one extra step on the way home. It's like graduating to home slowly, and this is like another tick.
Peter Sheehan, one of the oceanographers, was like, his feet were up on a table in the lab, and he was reading his phone, cackling, catching up on his favorite newspaper columnist.
Actually, this column is a little too vulgar to talk about on the BBC World Service, which is why I'm cackling in the corner.
You know, we've been on the ship for, you know, a month and a half, almost 2 months at that point. So the farther north we get, the antsier everyone gets, you know, to be back home and to get off the ship. We finally start to see Punta Arenas, the little town in southern Chile where we had gotten on the ship and where we would get off. And all of us gathered up on the bridge to see this little city approach.
Almost feel it. It's like right there, the land.
It's so close.
It's
like land was right there and we were about to get off the ship.
My Wi-Fi network on my phone is happening. Yeah. I don't know what to do.
Choices.
So we walk up the pier and we go to an ATM, which is, in all places, a casino. It was this total, like, sensory overload.
So where is it? One up?
One. He said this way.
And then we look around to find a bar because we all wanted a beer or something after 2 months on this ship.
Why don't we go to Shackleton?
We end up at the Shackleton bar.
Yeah, there are many of us.
And we all bring a bunch of leather chairs together and sit down. And toast each other with our first drink. There's a final group dinner the next night, and then everyone gets on flights and scatters. Then I'm flying back toward Boston. As the airplane lowers down over the airport, I'm really struck by the fact that it's completely surrounded by water. And it made me think about, you know, what will this look like if all that ice I saw in Antarctica really does melt? So if you look at the major climate reports, there's a huge amount of uncertainty about how much sea level rise we should expect by the end of the century. The big gold standard UN report, it projects up to 3 feet of sea level rise by 2100. And it only includes a little bit of melting from Antarctica. But its numbers have this big asterisk that's basically like, if Antarctica starts to collapse, these numbers could be really wrong. So I wanted to understand how a city plans for that uncertainty. And I thought there's no better place to do that than Boston. So my first stop is Boston City Hall, where I talked to one of the city's climate change officials.
My name is Alicia Pagan. I work with the City of Boston for the Environment Department.
Who tells me how much sea level rise Boston is planning for.
So we predict that there will be around 9 inches of sea level rise by 2030, around 3 feet or 40 inches by 2070, and then somewhere between either 2 feet or 7 feet by 2100.
So these numbers actually do take melting in West Antarctica into account, which surprises me because a lot of national and city figures don't. But even here in Boston, when we incorporate those numbers, it still doesn't mean you can plan that far out because the uncertainty is just so huge.
I think we'd like to plan for 2100. It's just the science right now is so uncertain that it's planning for a variance of 4 feet. So when we have better data, then we can make more informed decisions.
And I ask her,
the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is where I was this winter reporting.
You know, if we see the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet and there are 11 feet of sea level rise, is that something Boston can handle?
I don't have an answer for that.
And she basically said, we don't know yet. I don't know.
There's a lot of people interested in making sure that we can do this.
But you don't know yet if...
I can't say for sure right now. Yeah.
And that was really powerful to me.
Test 1, 2.
I wanted to get a sense of what 2 feet of sea level rise from Thwaites and 11 feet from the West Antarctic ice sheet would actually look like in Boston. So I walked actually across the street to Faneuil Hall.
This is one of the hearts of historic Boston. So it is actually the country's first mall was Faneuil Hall.
That's now a huge tourist destination in Boston. So there are a bunch of street performers and buskers out. And I meet up with Julie Wormser, who's from the Mystic River Watershed Association and is an expert in what sea level rise is going to look like in Boston.
With 2 feet of sea level rise in Boston, a storm that we would expect to have maybe once in a century before sea level rise starts to become once a year or once every 10 years.
And while that may not sound like a lot, how hard is it going to be to continue renting this vital retail space if it floods that frequently?
So there's so much commerce right here, right at risk of flooding.
Okay, so that's 2 feet. That's something that the city is planning for. But what does Boston look like if the whole West Antarctic ice sheet collapses someday? and pushes up sea levels by something like 11 feet. And she points out on the ground in the cement, there's this sort of squiggly line that shows the historic coastline of Boston.
That was the original shoreline of Boston.
Right in front of Faneuil Hall.
So on this side is water. So we're walking through water right now?
We are miraculously walking on water right now, for sure.
We're in an area that the settlers in Boston filled in and used to be the ocean.
They filled in a lot of the harbor with horses and shovels.
They filled in about a third of Boston.
So now about a third of the city of Boston is at risk of coastal flooding when sea level rises between 2 and 8 feet higher than it is today.
And if we see 11 feet of sea level rise, everything that was filled in Boston is going to be underwater again. And that's not just Boston. Bangladesh, much of the Netherlands, cities up and down the East Coast, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, they've all filled in marshes and ocean to build land. And all those places want to return to the sea. One estimate puts the cost of protecting just the U.S. from sea level rise for just the next 20 years at close to $500 billion. So the hard question going forward is going to be, who and what are we going to protect and how we're going to pay for it?
I got it.
So I wanted to talk to one more person whose neighborhood would be impacted by this massive sea level rise that would come from the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet.
All right, Carolyn, what do you want me to show you?
Marco Werman lives several blocks from the river in Cambridge.
Show me a couple of your
favorite I have him give spots. Me a bit of a tour of his favorite spots of his neighborhood.
Maybe my most important landmark in Central Square, which is John's Barbershop.
Where he's been getting his haircut forever.
Gave me my first haircut and gave me my most recent haircut in Boston. That started in 1995.
Wow.
So, yeah.
We walk down the street and go to his favorite used bookstore.
I love the smell. I love the vibe. And on a rainy day, I can just spend like hours in this car.
He likes to go in and he says, smell the old books.
So you can see Aleppo Palace from here, that little white building. What does
that
look like?
We go by his favorite falafel shop. And we stop just outside of his house, Victorian, I guess, where he lives on the top floor.
So you're about to see how I get greeted every day when I come home. Because the second he hears me, he's going to start barking.
And I pull out this map that's basically an elevation map of his neighborhood that shows, you know, with no protections, which there will be, you know, what will be underwater.
Yeah. So, right, yeah. So this is
Marco's house would be underwater.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm flooded.
The barber shop would be underwater.
Aleppo Palace could be okay.
The bookstore looks safe.
Yeah, they could move all the books on a high shelf. Yeah, I am in the risk zone.
And to me, this is why this matters. Because it's not acreage and square footage of land that will eventually be inundated. It's communities and stories and histories. It's sometimes hard to wrap our heads around why we should care about what happens to a giant chunk of ice thousands of miles away. But it really is all connected. And this piece of ice is going to have an impact on farms and global financial centers and historic places and communities just like this one, bookstores and barbershops all around the world. And this reporting has made me ask, okay, we get this data, what next? We get this better understanding of what this massive glacier might mean for communities all around the world. What next? What do we do with that information?
World's Carolyn Beeler produced that story with Ian Koss. The collapse of a glacier the size of Florida is hard to imagine, but we've got graphics. Go to theworld.org/Antarctica.